Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it's all about full compliance with the Constitution. That's why we're trying to help you understand some of the real nuances. How did they come up with, you know, the language, and more importantly, the lack of language? Because one of the things I realized in working on this Federalist Paper article, as I was going through some of the comments that Madison was making in fighting the Assumption Act. And so as he was fighting the Assumption Act, he made this point that during the Constitutional Convention, it was actually entertained and it was actually brought up and it carried and grew legs of the idea that the federal government would assume the debt. And they abandoned it at a certain point later on. And Madison points that out. So in other words, that news or that information came up, but it came up in a way like, hey, they talked about this, that this was the intent of being able to assume the debt of the Union, that they would assume, and the language isn't that in the Constitution, but they basically alluded to the fact that this was a part of the Constitutional Convention, that they would do this. And Madison said, yeah, it did come up. And the worthy member that was actually, you know, in the debates, I think it may have been Elbridge Gerry. I don't know, because I know Elbridge Gerry was kind of close to Hamilton because he was an anti-federalist that actually ended up regaining his position after he woefully repented of his ways. But he started aligning with Hamilton because Hamilton was trying to financially help the northern states. So anyway, long story short, Madison points his finger across the way and says, hey, yeah, I remember what you were saying. You were actually against this. So, and that's why we ended up abandoning it. or not necessarily because of him, but ultimately they abandoned it. And so, you know, it's interesting how you can start connecting unofficial support for these debates in the congressional records, or gain insight as to why they, you know, they were talking about admitting states at a disadvantage or whatever it is. And then all of a sudden the talk kind of just goes away because somebody threw out a death nail on the idea. Somebody basically has kiboshed it. And nobody wants to be kiboshed. I mean, at least that's a Seinfeld sub-reference. But anyway, welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
And I believe we've got to go back because we were kind of talking a little bit after the show. And I think it was one of those things that you may have even mentioned on the show that you'd like to go back and talk, because we kind of read what Mason was saying about the militia. And that's only the tip of the spear. They're going to dive heavily into the militia because it was, you know, I'll just say it was a trigger for him. I mean, he was a colonel. I mean, he was a military man. And so he understood the importance of a militia and the design of the militia in America and the maturity that it reached in many of the colonies, it became, you know, like, wow, why did they abandon that? It was working. So anyway, you said you might have some points or what have you. So let's
know. No, I was just...
Go ahead.
I think about when we talk about the militia, and I think about how that would look now.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to imagine with the way that our country has grown and the way the infrastructure is built out and the cities and everything and how those circumstances are, how the militia would work in modern times. because you currently have police force, and I know in my area it's not rampant, but there's enough crime to where if there was no police presence, there would be enough people with nefarious intentions that it would be like the old West.
Okay, so let's talk about how would we be able to phase in a full militia system and phase out the mercenary system. So first off, we have to look at the, to me, I start at the big picture. What is the militia? And the militia is every able body. Every able body serves, which means that everybody needs to have some level of training. Which means that at a certain point when a person is expected to be able to serve, they should have their fundamental training already by that point in time. And to understand the fact that the Constitution literally lays out that Congress will pay for that training, the training of discipline, the utilization of the weaponry, tactics, those types of things, to ensure that the states maintain a well-regulated militia. That's actually the language in the Second Amendment, which is why every man, you know, and the right for every person to bear arms. Now, we've kind of talked about, because back in those days, they didn't realize sociopaths and those types of things, that, you know, maybe we shouldn't put, you know, things that harm people in a sociopath's hands. But anyway, that's a point where we should actually come to, you know, how can we surgically protect society to ensure that everybody is armed, and as well as everybody that really it could pose a threat can still live free in society without, you know, being a threat. And that's a tough nut to crack, but that's a different problem. The problem is, how do we phase this in with the existing mercenary force system? Well, what you have to do is the sheriff would have to take over every, you know, the municipal or the mercenary force systems within their county. Now, this is kind of interesting because there are some states that, you know, like Cook County, I think makes up all of Chicago. And there are some suburbs and so forth that's outside of that. And then look at Atlanta. Atlanta has, I don't know, 30, 40 counties that make up Atlanta. So what, you know, what, not Atlanta, what Georgia may need to do is it may need to consolidate some of its counties to where, you know, they're larger and they're more, I'll call them community-based, even though like each, almost each county is a sub-community, like Fulton County. And we know, and the United States knows a lot about what's going on in Fulton County, and it's not good. But, and it's a very rich county. This is where there is lots of money. And so, anyway, the point is that the cognizant control over law enforcement has to transition or shift immediately to the sheriff, so that the sheriff, being the commander of the militia, can start implementing a transition that all people who are living in the community who are law enforcement become militia. Now, you, when you really look at the necessity of having, we'll call them boots on the ground, you know, actually men in uniform. Actually, let me rephrase that. People in uniform, because this is for everybody. So we have people in uniform, and so we will have people in uniform that are working on a day-to-day basis. We'll have people in uniform that come to work, you know, maybe every, you know, 6 months out of every, you know, 5 years or something like that, a rotation. And every state should needs to do this to make sure that every person maintains their standards of being able to perform their duties while they're alive. Because this is the obligation of being a citizen. And if you're not willing to be a citizen and actually be a part of the militia, then guess what? You can basically, because we see people doing this all the time, you can actually become a sovereign citizen and no longer have any rights. You can't vote, and you're just an inhabitant, and you're just, you know, kind of working or what have you. You won't have a gun. You know, you're just here. You're taking up space. And woe unto you if you violate the law because you don't have rights to due process. You won't have any of the rights protected by the Constitution. That's privileges for citizens. Now, the Supreme Court has it all wrong because as they laid it out from the framers, and the framers wanted everybody to become citizens, that they thought everybody would want to be citizens, which in their day, that's exactly how it was. But today, there we've created, I call it a nation of cowards. There are articles and books about that. But bottom line, as we transition, every person will be put in different statuses. You'll have inactive reserve, which means that for a period of time, you don't need to put your uniform on. You know, you don't need to do anything. And then you go into active reserve, and you do that before you go into active service. But active reserve is where you have to, you know, go do your rifle, you know, marksmanship, you know, refresh yourself on the discipline and the tactics and whatever you need to know in functioning within that county. And then you will go into what they'll call active service. But you'll be active service for the overflow work. Now, just keep in mind that the crime rate that we have today is at its peak because the design of the system allows crime to increase. But when everybody has to enforce the law, and everybody gets held accountable to that law, and the consequences of breaking the law will actually now be viewed as, you know, really, a crime against nature, a crime against humanity, kind of. And so the punishments, because I can honestly see that the desire of people wanting to violate the law would be not just a shame that they wouldn't want to bear, but the consequences would be that. But bottom line is that we would actually have a significant drop in crime, a significant drop in crime. And that one of the reasons why is because everybody that is either active reserve and or because if you're in active reserve, you don't necessarily have to carry your gun. It would be advised and recommended that all people carry their guns. And we know what happens in a society where all people are armed. Crime goes down dramatically. The armed robbery, the breaking and entering, all that. And everybody knows that there's a gun behind every door. Then the temptation of breaking past that door to find something that you might be able to, you know, make off of or, you know, gain something from, it really goes down. And there's studies that actually prove this. So the point is that as this transition occurs, and this would probably take a few years to really fully transition to a point where we have everybody trained and everybody in a cycle to where you have the county broken down into these different, you know, percentages or fractions, kind of like the rotation from active reserve, inactive reserve, and so forth. Now, you got to also remember that when we look at the militia, is the militia just a bunch of combatants? Is the army nothing but, you know, gun-toting infantry?
No, absolutely not.
And there you go. And so we're going to have these conscientious objectors. And that's okay. Back in those days, the militia, they basically, you know, had to pull a gun. I mean, you were a combatant in those days. But nowadays, because we have, you know, created, you know, the levels of technology and so forth, we need people capable of doing some difficult things that not everybody can do. You know, you literally, as an infantryman, you put everything on your back, you kind of made your own food, you know, and every time, you know, you got into base camp or what have you, where they had a mess hall, then, you know, life was large. I mean, it was like going to the Hilton. Right? I mean, you know, you've experienced this. And you have radio men, guys that literally tote the radio, guys that fix the radio, guys that work on aircraft. And so, okay, we're going to have these specialties. But technically, when you look at the county, if the county's a very rural county, then maybe it won't have its own airport. Maybe it won't have anything other than, and it'll be dependent on, a militia somewhere else for that other heavy lifting type of equipment, air power, what have you. Does that make sense?
But, yes, sir.
And this is where the state would actually create and actually come up with how they're going to manage their constitutional requirement of being able to execute the laws of the union, being able to suppress insurrections, and being able to repel invasions. Because every state and every person can be called to support and defend that Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. People who were not willing to execute the laws or follow the laws, like the Whiskey Rebellion, which we covered, I don't know, November time frame, or insurrections, which was basically same as the Whiskey Rebellion because it grew into an insurrection, or the invasion like we're talking about. There's over 50 million invaders, and that doesn't even include the importees of combatants that the federal government has brought in here that have right. No business being here because they cannot become citizens. Why did they bring people who were literally our enemy into our country?
That's a question everyone should be asking themselves.
Right. And those people who were responsible for this, the Bushes, the Clintons, Obama, Biden, and as a matter of fact, I even think Trump was duped into bringing in people from Syria. I think he really tried to stop that, but I think under his administration, there were some importations. I can't prove that. I'm not, and I don't want to speak out of turn.
The Somalis in Minnesota were brought here.
Yeah, but I think that wasn't in Trump's time, was it?
No.
Oh, okay, yeah. All of them.
Same. Most of these pockets where they have these groups of people that have basically just usurped the government and taken over, they have Sharia compounds in Texas, Ohio, Minnesota, and Illinois. And most of those people were brought here in bulk and dropped in one area.
Right. And so here's a petition that needs to be done if you live in a state that has a state in the state. And as a matter of fact, most all Western states probably need to have this petition as well, because you may not have an Islamic Sharia law state. But you do probably have a reservation that has created a federal state for Indians. It is unconstitutional. The federal government has no authority to create a sub-state within a state. That state is sovereign over all of its land, other than those lands in accordance with the Constitution that the federal government can possess upon purchasing through an agreement, through an accession, or an agreement from the state. The state has to acquiesce. Yeah, you can occupy this, arsenal, what have you. They just can't come in and say, we're putting an airfield here because we have a strategic need. They have to work through the state, and the state says, well, we consider that really valuable land. If you're going to take that from us, you're going to pay through the teeth for that. And oh, by the way, you're going to lease it. And you lease it, by every 3 years. And so every 3 years when your lease comes up, you're going to have to prove to us that you still really need and justify taking that land from us. There you go. Because that's what most states started doing, was leasing land. I know that the United States Marine Corps Air Station, El Toro, was a lease, which is why the people in the area, it's kind of funny. If you look at where El Toro is, it's in the southern Orange County, and it was very close to Nixon, and it was a base that was just kind of languishing, the Marine Corps Air Base was just kind of languishing there. And all of a sudden, Nixon, needed a close air base, and, who transports the president a lot? HMX-1 and so forth, so... let's bolster up. So they poured a lot of money, and they made the super airfield. I mean, if you ever looked at the runways and so forth, but long story short, El Toro was a lease by lease. And shortly after El Toro and Nixon was no longer, using it after the resignation and so forth, I believe it was in the late 80s or 90s time frame, where they decided, I think it was a part of BRAC, if you know what BRAC is. BRAC was the huge move of consolidating military installations, and El Toro was slated to go, and it did. It literally shut down. And that was, I believe, in the early 90s as a part of BRAC, and so when you go there, it's like this ghost airfield. And you would think that, you know, the civilian community, and what the reason why it was slated, though, is it was out in the middle of nowhere. It was literally in the middle of strawberry patches, orange fields, and so forth. It was an agricultural area. And these small communities started growing because they were leech communities. You know, the military air base needs logistics. They need, you know, these supplies. And so usually they start setting up towns outside because they become the providers, you know, the entertainment for the troops type of thing, right, or the Marines. And so these towns started really growing, and they became very affluent, and they had these high-end homes all around the Marine Corps Air Station. And next thing you know, everybody's complaining about that noisy airfield over there. You know, hey, you knew that was there. Why did you buy your house? Oh, well, because this is a nice house, and we don't need that anymore. And that's exactly what they did. They got rid of it. But anyhow, I digress. I think the point is that we have to transition away from, and it doesn't mean that most law enforcement, the guys that are, you know, driving around now, won't, you know, have a job. But if all of a sudden they become a part of a system that reduces crime and brings up productivity, in other words, when we're not having to spend a lot of effort in correcting people's behavior and so forth, the correction system, then wow, that's a good problem to have. And I know that people that have the job of doing something, well, you're replacing me. Well, isn't that a good thing to do? Especially in this capacity, right?
No.
And, you know, because it always comes up. The guy at the bowling alley with the automatic pin setting and the bowl return and all that. Oh, you replaced me. I don't have a job now. Okay, well, that's automation and invention and so forth. And okay, great. But in some things, we should really be working not to have and not to be plagued with these paradigms of allowing parasites to entrench themselves and start basically polluting and destroying our society. Because that's exactly what's happening. And the education is a huge part of this. A huge part of this. But now the military will actually, I should say, the federal government will only be providing education for the militia, and the rest of everything that they're dealing with would go away. Because at that point, hopefully, we've come to our senses and shut down all of these unconstitutional assumptions that the federal government has made, such as energy and all these other things. You know, does that answer the question? But if this is a transition, and the transition would actually be a very good thing. The sheriff would become the commanding officer, and everybody would be a part of the, you know, the responsibility of enforcing the law. And,
yeah,
and
does. I mean, there's a lot of kinks to work out, because when we think about it and talk about it, I mean, what about the people who just refuse to and say, how are you going to force me? It'd be like the draft. I know in a lot of countries, there's like in Germany, they have required military service for every male at a certain point in their life. They have to serve in the military. And I get what you're saying. I agree with it. But how do you enforce that?
Okay,
especially
so
from state to state, if
yeah,
it's
okay, so
goes underneath the militia, which is a federal.
No, it's not.
Constitutional mandate.
Okay, so the militia is a constitutional mandate that the states put on themselves. They're the ones that wrote that contract. Remember, the Constitution, we're going into a break. The Constitution creates roles and responsibilities not just for the federal government, but for the state governments as well. And so the states have this obligation of doing this. And so, again, and you're bringing up a good point, so remind me, because if I forget, because in 1 minute, you know, some shiny object will go by and I'll be totally cleared can't even remember my name. Anyway, we'll be right back after the short promo, folks. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me see if my gray matter kind of retained, you know, through that long pause of speaking. We were talking about the draft, and we were talking about how can this be done. Well, technically, just so you understand, the Constitution gave the management of the militia, who would be serving, who would be available, blah, 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 to the states. Congress was given the power to call forth the militia from the states and federalize them and put them into service. And the expectations of who, what, the type of MOSs, that type of thing, would be, you know, part of the request from Congress that this is what we need to do this function of. And again, they could only request the militia for three purposes. They couldn't call forth the militia to pack up a bunch of troops to send over to Germany or to France to fight, you know, a tyrant to remove them. That's not in the Constitution. You can declare war till Sunday, but you can't go prosecute a war by using the militia in any way. The only prosecuting force that you have externally to go to another nation would be the Navy and the Marine Corps. That's it. You have to amend the Constitution, and I'm telling you, when you really looked at the debates in Congress, in the ratification debates of the Constitution, and the debates, I believe, going through this Constitutional Convention, we're going to see how the states did not want this federal government to be able to just grab their young boys and send them somewhere and keep them over there. They wanted to make sure that they were being used close by, not to traverse the entire continent to go, you know, from Florida to serve in Washington or vice versa. So back to the draft. The federal government has no authority to execute the draft at all. What they did was they passed the Dick Act, and everybody thinks, well, they created these laws under this Dick Act. Well, hold on. Were the laws that they created in pursuance to the powers granted in the Constitution? Absolutely not. They literally defied what was in the Constitution, that the states would actually be the ones that would keep charge of the training, the promotion of officers, all of that. The states had the responsibility of doing things within each state. And of course, now hindsight being 2020, here's the problem with the Constitution. The Constitution didn't allow for the ability to change that so that we could, you know, create what we call, you know, reducing marginal cost of training, right? You have 50 states now. Do you really need to have 50 training centers, or would it be more incumbent of the different states to have regional training centers so that the different states could all participate in sharing the, you know, the benefits of that training. So in other words, you'd have a regional training center for artillery, a regional training center for helicopters, and a regional training center for ground pounding, and so forth, so that each state would actually be a regional training center. And they would, you know, be able to participate in the cash flow, because sometimes it's about the money. But bottom line, the federal government does not have the ability to do what it did in the Dick Act. This is where they assumed full control over the military. The National Guard is not something that is managed by the federal government. The National Guard is not an entity. That is literally a standing army. It's a standing reserve army. But it's not the evil standing army. The IRS is the evil standing army. The FBI is an evil standing army. When we go through the ratification debates, they'll talk about standing armies. They'll talk about the mischief of the standing armies. And we'll literally see how, as Mason starts talking about this, the whole point of a standing army has nothing to do with prosecuting warfare. It has everything to do of enforcing federal laws against the people in an oppressive way. They were aware of the fact that the king would literally seize property so the people couldn't feed themselves, to hurt them, to basically punish them. And that's why they wanted to make sure that the king or the government couldn't just call force the troops or the militia to execute the laws of the Union, because ultimately this became the ultimate and final check. Because if this is a mercenary force, they're going to keep the people from eating. But if this is a, you know, an organization that's pulled up out of the states and traveling around the Union to keep people from eating, they're not going to enforce that. They're going to actually realize that that is not a constitutional law. How is that in pursuant to the Constitution? The challenges will be easy, but when they assume laws and they create their own enforcement agencies, nobody even asks the question, hey, are these even legitimate? And so this is how they've created a bunch of standing armies that are far more nefarious than the National Guard. But the National Guard, in this idea of being able to deploy the federalized militia off the continental United States or outside of the United States boundaries, period, is completely unconstitutional. So the states would actually, because there's no point of a draft. The states would actually be managing their manpower, the militia manpower, so that the federal government would basically put its requisition in and say, we need these people to do this, these people to do this. And as long as it's a legitimate requisition, the states will fulfill it. We have a system. Go ahead.
No, I wasn't going to say anything.
Okay.
I was letting you go ahead.
So we have a system that is not legitimate. We have a system that has been concocted to let the federal government do anything, basically subjugating the states, and they've done all of this outside of the constitutional boundaries. In other words, they've violated the Constitution, they've assumed these powers, and these are not legitimate powers. Just like everything, so many other things. I mean, they do still have legitimate powers. I mean, they do still have the authority to create a uniform rule of naturalization. But messing around with that didn't get them to where they wanted to be in committing warfare against citizenship and about bringing enemies into the United States. This is why they don't follow a uniform rule of naturalization when they import a bunch of immigrants. They basically just bring them in. Okay, now you've been here this long. They don't go through the full immigration process like an immigrant. Just like the DACAs and just like these other, I'll call them, La Raza. You know who La Raza is, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so
a Reconquista.
Yeah, so they've got a lot of people that have come in that they've, you know, worked with, or wink, La Raza folks that, you know, are these activists, political activists, that have come across our southern border, and they call them DACA, and this is not all of them, but there are ranks of these radicals, and they just said, you know, instead of you having to go through the immigration process, we're going to waive that. guess what? The Constitution has granted the federal government no authority to make citizens out of these folks. They have the responsibility of creating a uniform rule of naturalization so that the states can execute the citizenship process. The states manage the citizenship process, period.
That's why it has to be a uniform, right?
That's right. Correct. There is no immigration powers granted to the federal government. The only thing that they have is they have the powers to regulate or basically deny states the ability to immigrate certain people or import certain people, such as slaves, sex slaves, working slaves, what have you. That was the whole point of that 1808 clause, that they should, in 1808, the federal government can then regulate who the states actually bring in. But the states, per the Constitution, still have that authority. And the whole idea behind this, and this boggles people's mind, you've got to be kidding me. The states have that authority? Of course. You think that they would have accepted a Constitution that the federal government would be able to dictate who you're going to get?
And where they're going to go?
Yeah, well, that's basically the same thing. But yes, correct. Who, what, where, how, why? No way. They would not have accepted that. The states knew who they wanted and who would be best to build and bolster their culture. So that when they started looking, you know, they started looking to bring in, you know, people that, you know, had the same trades or at least could complement what they have and so forth. I mean, it was all about making your state better so that you could be more productive. It wasn't about, you know, this idea of give us your trod. I mean, that's nice as a humanity thing, but there's no nation in the world that obligated itself to bring in the dregs of society. None. What America did. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so the local sheriff's department, civilian law enforcement, isn't necessarily unconstitutional.
The police departments are not a part of the militia. It is a professional working force that ultimately, as soon as you create a mercenary force, you then create the argument that you need to disarm your citizens. They knew that they needed everybody to be a part of the game, to be a part of the system, because in so doing, you would have a much stronger system that would preserve itself. When every cell of the body is working to preserve the body, then the body lives on. But when you allow cells to no longer, you know, support the body and start supporting themselves, then you get, you know, cancer. You get these other things and problems that destroy the body. This is why when I look at the Constitution and the way it was designed, the divine order that was created for we the people, it is almost like a human body, and the compliance is all, it's very similar to the immune system. That every cell is responsible for fighting any foreign, you know, germ, object, get rid of it, get it out of us. We're here to survive. Which when you look at the oath of the citizen, they take an oath to basically abjure allegiance to anything other than the body, i.e. the Constitution. And ergo, they also assert that they will take up arms and use deadly force to protect and defend the Constitution, the body of the United States. To me, I see this as a divine order. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just really delusional. But I think when you really start backing up and you really start looking at this architecture of this, the responsibilities of a citizen and the beauties of being a citizen, the protections we have, that we have these rights, that government can't oppress us. We are the government, and that we are the final check on the government. I mean, I could go on and on. I just see, you know, his love in that Constitution of giving us all the privileges and opportunities to do so many great things. And we've been squandering it because we've allowed ourselves to become one illiterate and be told what we have. I can't tell you how many times I engage in the same conversations, whether it be in social media, phone calls, what have you, or even in presentations, where people start, you know, talking about, you know, all of these problems. And I go, those problems are not legitimate problems. And they look and they go, well, they're taxes. Yeah, they've been getting away with it because you believe they're legitimate. Once you can prove that they're illegitimate and everybody else understands and starts proving that they don't, you don't have that power, that's when you take the power back. This is exactly what Martin Luther did with his 95 theses regarding the Catholic Church. He identified that, you know, this call for salvation, this church that was basically going to get everybody, you know, righteous to go to heaven. Well, shoot, 95 things that they were doing were not jiving with the scriptures, or vice versa. And so he pointed all of this out. And it took him 10 years to prove, but once the people understood that some of this stuff that they were being required to do was not on the path of salvation, they realized that they needed to change their course and reform Christianity to align with the Bible. That took 10 years. I believe our order is so much shorter and so much smaller because this is not something so personal and so intimate like salvation and religion. This is literally the law and the ability, or I should say, the rule of law, and whether they can do this or they can't, they can do that, period. And I think everybody, anybody that has common sense, logic, and reason, and I think that's 80% of America, will realize, yes, we're better off following the law and using the system to change these things if we don't want these things to have. You know, if we don't want to have these things anymore, we'll use the amendment process. At least we have the amendment process where they didn't, they did, under the Articles of Confederation, but they had Rogue Island. Rogue Island was the one that kept them because it was the death nail. But we have a system. You just have to make sure that what you're suggesting is such a good idea that you get 3/4 of the states to agree. And that's the reality. And see, the evil people realize that they'll never get 3/4 of America to buy into their evil ideas, which is why they started a long time ago with the Department of Transportation saying, we have to break through this wall so that we can actually start assuming power and nobody looks over our shoulder, which is why they started back in 1816. All of these things really began. 1816 is when Indiana became a state where the federal government assumed unconstitutional powers, telling Indiana it could, you know, it had to do these things with its property. It couldn't sell. It didn't have the cognitive authority over, they didn't have the authority over these salt mines. And so we started seeing them actually breaking through the parchment in 1819. By 1820, they started the first Ponzi scheme. We covered that last year as well. I don't think you were with us then, but anyway. Maybe I'm mad. Maybe I'm just, you know, this crazy guy that sees this body and immune system and so forth, or I see the likeness of this. But let me ask you, I mean, can you see that?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is have a cursory understanding of our history and start to look into a little bit, and you can see where, like you said, they're breaking through the parchment. They're doing things that were never intended to be done, and now we have these outcomes.
Right.
It's going to say, first they use the law and the government to enrich themselves and benefit themselves as far as power and control over society. And now they're just breaking down the law itself to where you just have madness. So they're hoping that, you know, we'll have a complete disassociation between the people and what they call rulers. Right. We're not even supposed to have rulers.
Correct. The law is our judge. The law, I should say judge, the law is our king. And as long as...
I guess my confusion was just between, and I think I understand it better now, the militia is for protecting and the things that it's stated in the Constitution.
Yes.
But like for civilian law enforcement and peacekeeping within counties or communities,
okay,
they delegate the power, the people delegate the power to whatever system that they choose for their community, and that's separate from
and they'd
the
be fools to do that. And see, they'd be fools to do that, because if you really look at it, so here we go. Let's look at this transition. As you create a county constitution, you'll establish the county militia. The county militia will basically transition and take over all law enforcement within that county. In other words, all law enforcement that currently exists will instantly fall underneath the sheriff's office, and they will no longer be municipality forces, they will be sheriff forces. And at that exact same time, every citizen within that county will actually be, just like jury duty, every citizen within that county will then be called to, you know, a day of training or a level of training to help prepare them to become a member of the militia. This constitutional requirement. Every state has a requirement of actually mandating that their citizens, if it came down to, you know, the nuclear option, all people must be called to serve. And that is a requirement of the citizen. Therefore, any citizen that says, I do not want to be a part of this militia, based on conscientious objection, they say, I don't want to be a trigger puller. Oh, that's fine. You'll be a cook. You'll be a truck driver. You'll be, you know, a medic, a corpsman, whatever. And as a matter of fact, there won't be any Navy or Marine part of this. That's completely separate. So anyway, so the citizens will then have to decide, do I want to be able to be a part of this governing system that is a constitutional three-tiered system, a hybrid constitutional republic, or do I want to give up my citizenship and just become an inhabitant? Because that's your option. You're going to serve one way or the other, and you're going to learn an MOS, and you're going to be able to contribute, and so forth and so on. You will be a part of the system, and if you execute or get involved in an insurrection against this, then woe be unto you, because what is the charge of an insurrectionist? Based on the history and based on the constitutional precedents, that's treason. And you may not have Washington to pardon you, to try to, you know, help everybody, you know, unite around the Constitution. By this point in time, you know, I think we just need to start cutting our losses. And I don't want to be callous, but the bottom line is everybody should understand that freedom isn't free. Everybody should understand that the liberties that we possess comes with responsibilities and accountability, that we're all, and we have to hold all. This is why, what is the solution of getting government back into check and into the constitutional framework? It's called accountability. We have to hold them accountable. It's our job to be, it's our responsibility to hold them accountable. That's why when we talk about liberty, accountability as well as responsibility are entwined with liberty. And as a matter of fact, this kind of goes down, you know, this old, you know, I actually put this is a little saying I put in my book. It says, civil society is wholly dependent upon the symbiosis between the fundamental principles of liberty, free agency, responsibility, and accountability. When these principles are balanced and in harmony with the individual citizens, liberty can then act as a catalyst in elevating the synergy within the community and society. These synergies will lead to stronger spiritual well-being, greater productivity, improved health, and the development of wealth. And I challenge anybody to prove me wrong on that. If we actually came together and we lived under this thing we were given called the Constitution, and we're fully enforcing and living this to every... you've heard me say this. The U.S. Constitution was the exemplar. It wasn't enforced. It wasn't forced to you. Every state has to take this on. Every state recognized that was a better governing document than anything they've ever seen. which is one of the reasons why every state created constitutions kind of similar to it. And they deviated. They didn't realize that some of their deviations would become very problematic down the road. Now, 200 some odd years later, it's time to kind of, you know, shake the cobwebs off of and out of our head and start realizing that we need to really clean up and make our systems, I don't want to say exactly, but we need to use the U.S. Constitution as the example, the gold standard, and how we integrate that into our county and into our state. And by doing that, we now have actually embraced this concept of liberty, the concept of applying those fundamental principles of free agency, responsibility, and accountability, and watch us flourish. We won't have corporations and we won't have people working in companies that are willing to, you know, feed themselves profits at the expense of killing everybody in the state or in their community because they're polluting their community. They'll recognize this is harmful. We can't do this. Everybody will become a steward and an equal participant. And those people that we find in society that do evil, we will put them, you know, out from us. There's no place for them here, and we're not obligated to have our enemies in our homes. So, anyway, anywho, for what it's worth, I know this whole show kind of really focused on the militia and this concept of, you know, the citizens' responsibility of enforcing and kind of being that ultimate check. Folks, that's why I keep saying, if you're not going to do this, we're screwed. You are the problem. We are the problem. I was the problem. I'm not being the problem anymore. And I'm inviting you to be a part of the solution. Because if you're not a part of the solution, guess what? You are a part of the problem. You can't straddle this. If you still have your foot in the part of the problem, then you're still a part of the problem. There's no straddling. You can't straddle heaven and hell. Right? Right, Sean?
Definitely not.
Okay.
So, can't serve two masters.
That's right. And so, anyway. Yes. I hope that this kind of helps clarify. So moving forward, and this is GR's... as I have read these founding documents and I've read these, you know, the framers' positions through these founding, these principal source documents that built this nation, there's no doubt in my mind that these men, you know, somebody just didn't concoct this in a closet. These men came together and they were inspired, as we just read yesterday, that inspirational call, the appeal to heaven by Benjamin Franklin, Dr. Benjamin Franklin. So, anyway, and so when we come back, we'll have Tammy with us, and we're going to dive into, I believe, Hamilton, who was basically kind of protecting, you know, his plan because it was kind of a response and response regarding property. So when we come back in our next episode, we'll actually get back into content. Folks, I hope this really helps. I hope that maybe if you start reading with us, you'll start sharing these paradigms with others and get them to read. It's kind of like finding Christ in the scriptures, finding Christ in the Constitution. These documents are equal. He's equally there. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.